Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast where the debts are all psychic. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and special guest star here in the Paloma Media booth, the very crowded Paloma Media booth, subbing in for Catherine Mankiw Ward. It is Liz Wolf. Claps. Nice to see two-thirds.
I think she's doming it.
In person? Doming?
Yeah, as opposed to subbing.
Oh, I get it.
Or, yeah.
I get it. That we're starting off like that.
It's good that we're in the same room, Matt, so we can have this class A chatter.
I do not consent to any of this.
Yeah, that's fine.
Happy Monday, y'all.
Hi, Peter.
Who's that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's somebody else on the line.
He can't even see us anymore. It's great. We're going to talk in a moment about Joe Biden's magic trick. Even better than Gillespie's.
Floating hand.
Floating hand. This is great for people listening because they can't, yeah.
Well, you know, Matt, when we grew up with radio, we had voices.
Yeah, that's right. Anyways, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, looking for your next podcast? Check out The Political Orphanage, hosted by your friend, Andrew Heaton. The Political Orphanage is designed for people who don't feel at home in the Republican or Democratic parties. Rather than explaining issues as slap fights between Team Red and Team Blue, Heaton looks for the underlying problems to the biggest issues, all while cracking jokes along the way. This month, for example, Andrew flew to Berlin to interview a historian about Nazi economics and whether Hitler was a socialist or a capitalist. This week, he's talking to comedians about social justice as a religion, and later this month, he's doing a special on what all happens in the event of a thermonuclear war. It's funny, wonky, nonpartisan, with cool guests, and it's hosted by Andrew Heaton. Check out The Political Orphanage today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Last Wednesday, President Joseph Robinette Biden II announced an executive order to cancel $10,000 of federally held student loan debt for all borrowers who currently make less than $125,000 a year. Former recipients of need-based Pell Grants will be eligible for up to $20,000 of relief. The debt burden is so heavy, Biden said, that even if you graduate, you may not have access to the middle-class life that the college degree once provided. Peter, we've talked about this issue several times previously on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Now that the thing has arrived, like Beaujolais Nouveau, what are aspects about it that you find of particular note?
You mean besides the fact that it's inequitable, illegal, cynical, and a huge waste of resources?
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, that's what stands out to me. It's inequitable, illegal, cynical, and a huge waste of resources. So the White House has kind of notably hedged and squirmed on the distributive effects of the program. Somewhat amazingly, they announced the plan before the Department of Education even ran the numbers on this. So there are no official White House numbers on how this is going to shake out in terms of who is going to get this money. And when you ask them questions, they say things like, well, it depends on the take up. And you ask them to estimate it if there's 100% take up. And they're like, there's just no way to know. You couldn't possibly know. But the plain fact is they made the choice to provide this handout to single earners making $125,000 a year and two-income families making up to $250,000 a year. That is not the poor and the struggling working class. Just about every analysis shows that the bulk of the benefit is going to go to middle and upper income earners, not struggling workers. And something that's been remarked on less is that while there's an income cap on this for today's income, that's not for future income. And so a lot of those 25-year-olds who make, say, $75,000 or $100,000 now, which is a lot for a 25-year-old, are going to end up making a lot more in the future. So this disproportionately benefits people who have high potential earnings, as well as people who are already well into the upper or upper middle class. It's also illegal. And everybody knows this, including Nancy Pelosi, who said flatly last summer on the record that the White House cannot forgive student loans. The White House is justifying this somewhat hilariously and desperately based on a post-9/11 law, the HEROES Act. That's for our terrible acronym law files, the Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students Act of 2003, that allows the Secretary of Education to modify student loans, quote, to help students and their families or academic institutions affected by a war, other military operation, or national emergency. And the emergency they are citing here, of course, is COVID. And that's why this whole thing is just so cynical. This is not a systematic reform of student loans or higher ed. It's just a one-time handout to a cohort that doesn't need it, but does disproportionately vote for Democrats, and it's conveniently timed for the 2022 midterm election.
Liz, you're a 25-year-old, close to it. How close are you, though?
I'm 26.
26. All right.
That's all over.
This child has
aged. Why are we talking to her?
Yeah. Because we're trying to figure out, help her figure out how to plug in her own computer. This caused a social media firestorm. Like, people latched onto it and started arguing. And since you never take my advice about never tweeting, you were in there too. But you also wrote about this. Can you talk about so you were a person who did the responsible thing. The retort to you is like, why do you want to pull up the ladder for people who weren't, able to pay off their loans as deliberately as you did?
Yeah, I mean, my specific situation was I went to a completely boring, pretty good state school, the College of William and Mary.
Excellent school.
Yeah, it's excellent if you don't have to go there, right?
I'm just saying, on paper, yeah, no, it's a very highly regarded, highly selective plus institution.
Yeah. One of the most expensive in the country for out-of-state students.
Make sense to talk about. And when you're talking about public schools,
it's
great. I mean, it's a great school.
Yeah, it's great, but it's very much a feeder school for federal government type employees. Jen Psaki went there. James Comey went there. It's the type of place where if you want
Thomas
to
Jefferson.
Be, in the FBI or the NSA or be sort of a mid-level government bureaucrat and work in the DMV area for the rest of your life, it's a really, really great fit for you. If you have any aspirations sort of beyond that, I didn't think it was a very good fit for me. I chose it because it was a state school, and I chose – I realized that I would not be able to afford 4 years of in-state tuition there, so I went for 2 years. And I graduated after that time, and I worked partially for Reason – partially in a whole variety of other odd jobs, partially in some unsavory professions that I won't go into. Like, there was
a
mixture of things.
It's not nice to talk about the Federalist that way, but go on.
There was a mixture of things, and basically my entire motivation was I'm not going to take out any debt. I don't want to deal with that, and I know I want to be a journalist after this, and I've heard the word on the street is that 22-year-old journalists don't get paid super handsomely, so I better make sure that I minimize my debt burden. So I did that. I do want to pull the ladder up. I struggle a little bit with the fairness and pulling the ladder up argument because I think it's actually a really important component of how we create laws in this country, which is like unfairness matters. The degree to which something is fair, the degree to which something is arbitrary is actually something that we care about a lot. I don't think this is just a phenomenon of conservatives and libertarians wanting to screw over everybody else or wanting to make it so other people have it extra hard. I think there's a sense of, because many of us did this, there's a sense that it's achievable for many people. There's a sense that it's doable. There's a sense that people should not necessarily have these handouts that make it so that other working people are paying for their choices, but that they should bear some of the consequences and bear some of the costs.
Of course, because they're getting most of the benefit. I mean, a college education, graduating with a BA, according to the government, and these are median lifetime earnings figures, $900,000 is the median extra in lifetime earnings for men, $630,000 for women. That's one figure. There's a wide range of these things, but there's no question that going to college increases your lifetime earnings. So you should pay for college as much as you possibly can, because most of the benefit goes to you. People graduating, and again, these we can debate figures all the time, but about the typical undergraduate coming out of college who borrows, and in 2020, according to Student Loan Hero, which is a publication of LendingTree, which is a consortium of banks that funnel people for loans and things, 55% of the class of 2022 took out loans to go to college. The average payment for people graduating college, which isn't everybody, is $300 a month. It's a fucking good deal to borrow that money to go to college and then be able to make a lot more money over the course of your lifetime. Plus, actually, like, enjoy yourself and learn not simply random facts, but a framework. I talk about this stuff as somebody who paid completely for my college, and I have paid completely for my kids' college. And that's like the thing, besides being a co-author with Matt Welch and sitting in this kind of increasingly hot, sweaty booth with him and a pregnant woman, you know, among the highlights of my life, you know, because like I don't want my kids to have to, you know, take out loans to pay for school, et cetera. But I did, and it was a great idea, and it was a great thing. And this program is nuts because it's being talked about as there's a student loan crisis. And there's no crisis. Some people have really bad student loans. Some people who are poor got fucked over or screwed over and, you know, and they need help. People making 120 grand a year don't need help, or at least it, not the kind of help where you just wash away, you know, 10 grand of their student debt or something like that.
The upper income threshold really is the thing that pisses me off the most about this because, you know, they're basically saying that for a household that makes $249,000 a year, they are eligible.
Which is rich.
Yeah.
Anywhere in the country. You are,
or the world.
You are in the upper
income. It's also upwardly mobile, right? Yeah. Like that's, to me, when I look at, you know, my household or other households like me, like I'm married to somebody a few years older than me who's also a college graduate. There's not a conceivable case to be made that we are a household that's struggling that then needs to be taking advantage of this program at the expense of at other taxpayers' expense. And so it's very confusing to me how we set the threshold this high. It makes sense if you look at the political reasoning and political motivations, but it doesn't make sense from a basic fairness standard. I also think it's worth considering, like, this just incentivizes colleges to make the situation completely worse. I encountered this when I was in college, and in order to graduate in 2 years instead of four, I had to petition the college administrators to let me overload with credits. So typically they would recommend you take 14 credits or 16 credits and really do high quality work.
Yeah, I mean, you graduated in 2 years, like, and without coming in with like 2 years of community
college. I came in with some amount of college credit from VCU, some amount of college credit from AP classes. I was pretty strategic about taking VCU classes because that was another public in-state school in Virginia.
Virginia Commonwealth University.
Yeah. And actually the quality of instruction was quite good there in a lot of classes. But regardless, I came in with a little bit of credit, and then I had to petition the administration to let me take 21 credits one semester. And they kept having these very paternalistic concerns of like, oh, well, golly, can you handle it? And it's like, well, wait a second. You guys have an incentive to make this hard for me to do because that means you can eke an extra semester's worth of tuition out of me versus me being the judge.
I think it makes sense. You know, like there is a, you know, no, I mean, it's good that you could petition and got your way. But, you know, the idea of taking,
I think
they
just got sick
courses,
of dealing with me at a certain point.
Taking eight courses a semester, I could see it being like, eh, you know, that's like a little bit much.
But I did that.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's because incredibly impressive.
But it was worth it to me. And it was also worth it to me because I was going into an industry where, unlike consulting or working for some really, really big company, I knew that my GPA wasn't going to be a factor, and I, in fact, wanted to make it harder for me to have access to grad school, where they actually do consider your transcripts and your GPA. So my logic was, all I need to do is pass, but I don't need to actually have a GPA that's...
Matt Welch is taking life pass-fail. you're off the grading completely.
I don't even know what the word grade means. Peter, join the chat. The White House over the weekend, I think it was, sent out a Twitter thread. And man, were the blue check journalists just
mashing. They're dropping bombs in Syria and Twitter threats and truth bombs on Twitter.
They were shaming various Republican backbenchers like Marjorie Taylor Greene and whatnot for as being hypocritical because they opposed this, and they also got loan forgiveness via the federal PPP program. I realize that you have all federal policies tattooed on the inner part of your forearm. Is that an available, is that indeed hypocritical for someone who got their loan forgiveness through PPP to be against this?
The PPP was a terrible program. It was poorly designed, poorly executed. The money didn't go where it was supposed to go, where the people who, you know, passed the law said it was going to go. This was supposed to, if you recall, help keep workers employed, keep them on the payrolls. Instead, most of that money ended up going to relatively well-off business owners. Once again, we see that giant pots of federal money that are supposed to go to help working class people end up helping the middle and upper middle class, right? That's just what keeps on happening. But the the program was also rife with fraud. There was a report that came out within the last week or two where there was some law enforcement official who said something to the effect of, there's just so much fraud, we can't keep up with it. Like, we're just drowning in fraud cases here. And like, and it's true, because it was the program was just designed to shove money out the door rather than to actually deliver it to people who needed it and to put basic checks in place. The fact that the PPP was bad does not in any way justify another terrible program. And this is the terrible logic of politics that you see all the time. Hey, the other side or someone else did something that was terrible, therefore we're going to do something terrible too. Also, the PPP was, the Paycheck Protection Program was in many ways designed to be a forgiveness program in which it was they were structured as loans, but pretty much from the outset, the understanding was that no one was really going to have to pay them back unless they were committing, you know, fraud or something like that. And so the idea that a program that was terrible, that was enacted at a time of emergency, that was more or less intended from the outset to be forgiven, is somehow or another a justification for doing what Joe Biden did, which was give a bunch of money to six-figure earners who happened to vote Democratic right before the midterms. It's not a very good argument, and it's kind of horseshit.
I want to drive Peter insane by throwing out long phrases and having him come up with acronymic names for the programs, like the the Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich Act, right? Matt Welch, you would remember that from that book, I think, or movie, something like that. From that golden age of 70s culture?
Nope.
When young adult people were getting real for the first time. I agree completely with Peter. And the idea that you can't critique a system because you benefited from it, that's like saying, Anne Frank can't argue about, you know, trains. Like, she got so many free train rides in Nazi Germany. She should just shut up about everything else.
Did you just Godwin right here live?
Mike Godwin?
Yeah.
Adolf Godwin? Yeah. No, but it is, you know, Peter is right to focus on this as pure politics, and it's been building for at least a decade or more, the idea that student loan debt, when it crossed the $1 trillion figure, as if that isn't a sign that more people are taking advantage of going to college and taking loans out and things like that, because it's not... You know, it isn't like everybody's on the hook for the total amount. You're on the hook for like $300. If you're a total schmo, you might be on the hook for like, you know, $50,000 to go to a private college and get a BA. That's you're not going to be helped by $10,000 in debt forgiveness because you're stupid and that's not coming back. You know, this has been building for a long time, the idea that college needs to be free, independent of the school you go to, independent of everything else. And you're starting to see that among politicians. This is all pure politics, and it's all pure midterm politics because Biden is doing so poorly. He's ticked up a little bit over the past couple of weeks, but he is terrified, rightly so, that the Democrats are going to get blown out in the midterms. And this is a way of delivering on a promise he made as a Democratic candidate because everybody had to, and no young people like him. Even if he gets a lot of votes, he's just, you know, he's a low energy candidate for young people, and this is a way to kind of try and get them.
The cynicism is really remarkable, and it's just it's worth thinking about,
and that it's not being talked about.
It's worth thinking about
what
like the reverse of this would be if Republicans did it, and the best I could come up with would be if Republicans gave $10,000 grants to anyone who has children and lives in a county that is and attends church regularly and lives in a county that is at least 50 miles from a functioning mass transit system, right? That money wouldn't go exclusively to Republicans. There'd be some Democrats, some lifelong Democratic voters who would get that money. But it would be like, I mean, it would be a program that would be clearly designed strictly to funnel money to people who consistently turn out to vote for Republicans. And that is what this is. And I think, you know, one thing I will say is I've seen some polls that suggest this is popular. And it might actually help Democrats in the midterms. It might actually boost turnout amongst young people or people who might not otherwise vote. And it might help Democrats do a little better here. And if that happens, then there is going to be pressure on Democrats to do this again, because for the most part, this was a one-time thing. And so this might not just be one $500 billion waste of money that is incredibly cynical. This might turn out to be a series of them over time.
We would be best served by ripping this entire system to shreds, and not by pumping more money into it, but by encouraging people to think much more creatively about how they get jobs in this country, what the transition from high school to adulthood looks like, what types of things we incentivize them to do, what types of societal expectations we have for them. There are a whole bunch of different ways to become a successful and wage-earning person. And I think it's really, really messed up that we've sort of funneled people into this as the default, especially acting as if colleges are these benevolent, wonderful little brochure, cutesy brochure handing out forces, when in reality, like, a lot of the time, they're just suckling money away from you. You're not necessarily getting great ROI. It very much depends on the degree you're pursuing. It depends on how much money you're spending. It depends on whether you're in state or out of state. I think we would be better served not by propping up this system, but by attempting to dismantle it. And I think it's pretty telling that a lot of pundits on the left side, the left-leaning side, are pretty hostile to that. Matt Iglesias has been covering this issue pretty intensely, and he has a lot of stuff about how, oh, well, the European college model isn't so good because it's such a stripped-down version of higher education.
Yeah, football teams.
And, yeah,
have
and
you guys
I very much
seen
disagree
Texas
with that.
Tech's water park? Google it. It's amazing.
It's bullshit, right?
And they brag about it on their website. They're like, we keep winning awards for our recreational swimming facility. They have a lazy river.
Raiders.
Yeah, you don't need a lazy river,
yes,
right?
You
like
do.
That's...
Have you ever been to Lubbock? I think you do.
Yeah, there's nothing else
there's
to do.
There's a reason
there, right?
Why Buddy Holly was like, no, I'll get on the plane. Because yeah. It's heading away from Lubbock.
I think
you're right.
But I think Iglesias is wrong to be overly dismissive of this. And to me, that's very telling. It's like, well, wait a second. Why are you dismissing this so quickly? I did college in the United States in 2 years. Didn't particularly like it. Now have a career that I like a lot. My brother, a few years younger than me, did college in the EU, has stayed in the EU ever since then, in Germany, former East Germany. And he had that stripped down, slimmed down college experience. He didn't have the traditional experience that many of his high school friends in the United States had. And I think he was better served by it. He worked in cargo shipping with a bunch of chain smoking, like commies, former like dudes who lived under communism, commie haters. I think that was very character building. And so in a sense, he got... he's a little bit less naive and a little bit less sheltered than I think a lot of other people his age are. He got an econ degree and he got some experience loading a bunch of packages onto cargo planes that are going from Warsaw to Leipzig. Like, what more could you ask for, right?
I did that at UPS after graduating from Rutgers, which, like College of William & Mary, is a colonial college and a state school. It shares that. Also a land-grant college, Matt, and it's a space university, which is some kind of designation. I don't know what that means.
Nick.
It's got it all, and it's also an aqua thing. But I loved college. I think college is great. I am the type of person who benefited from college being massively expanded, it both psychically as well as economically. I agree with you. You know, part of the other thing with this, and I know Peter has talked about this too, the way the student loan program works in this forgiveness program, it does nothing to reduce the cost of college. It actually will speed up inflation. But I you know, you were picking on lefties who are, you know, talking about this stuff. I find the anti-intellectualism among a lot of right-wingers, including a lot of libertarians, who think exclusively the only thing people are taking who want loan forgiveness, oh, you know, they're doing lesbian poetry, slam activism or something. And you know what? Like, the anti-intellectualism of the right and the hatred of college, which has cropped up over the past decade, is phenomenal. And it's really bad, and it's really short-sighted. I think college is great. I think it should be more affordable. I think everybody who wants to go to college should have that opportunity. They should not be able to cost it onto everybody else. But I want to just say the four-year residential college experience, which is fast becoming not the typical thing. It was for, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years, and it might fade. But, man, that's great. And I want people who, you know, who can benefit like that from me, somebody who grows up lower middle class. You get launched into a different concept of the idea that you could have a career that is journalism as opposed to whatever else I was going to be doing.
I wonder whether you're also reacting, like we went to college at very different times in the U.S. I wonder whether you're also reacting to a sense that this was your introduction to what elite intellectual culture could be like. It was this very obvious tool of upward mobility, whereas I saw college much more as a coddling exercise where it kind of felt like you're treating these 18-year-olds as if this is this prolonged summer camp type experience versus something that actually transitions them into being intellectual powerhouses. The college that you're describing sounds much more appealing to me than the one that I experienced.
I was going to say, and this goes to the lazy river comment, and again, I don't think like it should, you know, college should be like Stalag 17 or something like that, but it's, you know, at Rutgers and every school, public and private, had some variation of this, where we called the bureaucracy, the system, the RU screw, because every semester you would get deregistered from classes, or they would say, oh, now you owe this, or you didn't do this, or whatever. And, you know, kind of negotiating or navigating the bureaucracy was as important as what you were learning in the classes. So it was very different that way, but that screwed up too. And that changed even by the time I graduated, it was already changing. And, you know, my older son went to Ohio State, which was at various points in the 70s and 80s, the largest college in America. It was bigger than UT. Now it's like UCF. Yeah, the Ohio State. And they were famous for, you know, just losing students. It was like, you know, you're like foster kids in the Florida system or something. Like they just had no idea what would happen to like thousands of students every year. And they had changed their tune because they were losing good students because of that. So, you know, there's got to be a mix between treating kids like they don't matter or coddling them. But again, intellectually, man, the 4-year college, you know, experience I had, I hope everybody who desires that is able to access it. And that's one of the things that pisses me off about this. It doesn't really do that. This is, you know, this is throwing some money to people who are likely to vote for you anyway.
Peter put a bow on this by reflecting a little bit. This was done in the wake of the Inflation Reduction Act, which President Biden was bragging about in terms of reducing inflation and also reducing the debt. How does this mix with the Inflation Reduction Act in terms of inflation and debt?
So the best argument for that the Inflation Reduction Act would, in fact, reduce inflation was that on paper, it was scored as reducing the deficit by about $300 billion. Now, we don't have an official score for Biden's student loan plan, in part because it's not legislation. This is being done purely through the executive branch. And so the Congressional Budget Office, which scores bills, doesn't score this sort of thing. And like I said, this was put out so hastily that the Department of Education had not yet produced any numbers. But reputable outside modelers have looked at this and said that it is likely to cost at least $300 billion. And probably more like $500 billion. So if you combine these two things, all of that deficit reduction, again, which was on paper, all of the scored deficit reduction from the Inflation Reduction Act is completely wiped out by Biden's student loan program. And that is assuming that no Democrat, no politician ever does this again. And so I think, you know, the question this leaves me with is, how is anyone going to learn to think, like learn to be an intellectual without a 645-foot lazy river and a 25-person hot tub?
Or in the case of UC Santa Barbara, a 20-foot bong. All right, we're going to go to our...
And that was the end of your college experience,
it's
right?
The beginning.
Yeah.
These guys had, because they had a lot of two-story houses in Isla Vista, so they had like a 6-foot one that they called the Terminator.
Did they make it out of PVC pipe or like cups nesting within?
And I think there might have been like a motorcycle engine involved.
Yeah. See, if you have hot tubs in college, you can use grav bongs as opposed to normal bongs.
That's
and so that's sort of the prison equivalent.
The gravity bong is so great. But unfortunately, my experience, again, at Rutgers, which at the time I was there was calling itself Rutgers Comma, the State University of New Jersey. Milton Friedman went there when it was still a private university, but people would do gravity bongs and then they would get so high they would trip and like the entire 54-gallon garbage can filled with water in order to use the gravity would spill into the hallway. So you would have like a bong water smell. Like I still get triggered by it sometimes, just by random city odors.
Let's segue from there into our listener question of the week. A reminder, email your succinct queries and any relevant pronunciation guide to roundtable@reason.com. This one, which we've been saving up for a special occasion, comes from Tyler Wolf, if that's your name. We found out last week that Swift Griggs was a real name and like a fantastic story behind it. This comes from Tyler Wolf, who writes in part, "Why is the abortion debate within libertarianism treated so dismissively by everyone on the Reason Roundtable? Most other topics are approached with an even-handedness that attempts to at least acknowledge that those who disagree with the panelists are doing so in good faith and are at least attempting to be reasonable. It's not surprising that everyone on the roundtable is pro-choice, but why can't you all acknowledge your disagreement with pro-life libertarians is over fundamental values that libertarianism cannot resolve? The way you approach the subject makes your own colleagues, like Liz Wolf, into pariah libertarians who have no place in the movement." It goes on to say, "Why does everyone on the roundtable go around masquerading as if their position on abortion is based on pure reason and science and the only acceptable libertarian position, instead of acknowledging that it really boils down to values and you don't value a baby's life before she is born more than the mother's autonomy?" I'm going to let Liz answer first, just because I want Nick to continue steaming out of his nose. Liz, do you feel like...
You know what? I'm just upset that, I don't know, maybe unborn children at 15 weeks aren't getting in on that $10,000 student loan deferment. Liz, you know, just put that in an account for them, let it accrue interest, and then, you know, they're millionaires by the time they're born.
Are you indeed a pariah in libertarianism, a pariah at Reason Magazine, Liz Wolf?
I don't feel like a pariah. I think there's actually a significant contingent of pro-life libertarians. I don't think we actually know how many there are. Our best estimates are roughly maybe 30 to 40% of libertarians self-identify as pro-life. And I think sometimes people attempt to link this to the influx of sort of slightly conservative libertarians with the Ron Paul movement.
And revolution.
The revolution. And I think that that's actually probably not true. I think that's tracing the origin story in an incorrect and unlikely way. I think we actually see...
It's mostly the involvement of incels into the libertarian movement.
I think that we see actually an interesting generational breakdown where, like, the vast majority of my recent colleagues who are very staunch pro-choicers, I think, tend to be maybe 45 and above or so.
Come on, it's me and Ron Bailey, and we're both in our late 50s or older.
No, I think there's a significant, I don't know.
Because Matt, you're not really, you're like kind of wishy-washy.
I'm safe, legal, and rare.
Well, I think there's a really interesting breakdown where I think on Reason's masthead, we have maybe 5 or 6 pro-life libertarians who would identify as such. And then I think we actually have a pretty big contingent, maybe 6, 7, 8 people who are squishes, who don't really see abortion as something
safe,
that
legal,
we should...
Safe, legal, and medium rare.
Yeah, basically. But I think that's actually somewhat telling. I mean, one thing that we all recognize, and Nick, I want to recognize you also
for like being pro-life and actually having kids.
Well, this is against
my will. It's real easy for like, you know, the neckbeards, not on our masthead, but elsewhere, to be like, I'm against abortion because
I have every incentive to be pro-choice, right? Because like I want to be able to live in a sexually liberated, less sexually repressive type world. Right. I'm not from some sort of religious subculture or ultra-sheltered
slamming those people on the Reason masthead
type. No, I'm just saying like I have lots of incentives to fully embrace my right to get an abortion, and yet still, there has always been something, even when I was secular and even when I was, much younger and didn't actively have a fetus inside of me right now, where I've been pretty consistent on this. And I think it's because there's something that you have to morally sit with. There is an awkwardness to this issue because we feel differently about a fetus at different stages of development. One thing that I think pro-choicers sometimes think is a consolation for people like me is the fact that so many abortions take place super early on. 92% of abortions take place within the first trimester, the first 12 or 13 weeks. And at least for my part, that's not very comforting because a lot of the major organs are developed between weeks, about weeks 8 and 12. We see by week 11, a baby has fingernails. We see the heart dividing into four chambers around week 10, week 11, and beginning to actually function as a circulatory system. If you're trying to say that, you know, human life at week 11 is insignificant, I think that that's a really flimsy argument. I think we don't have a very clear place to draw this line. And I think attempts to do so are really fraught. And I think in general, as libertarians, we should recognize that writing a law doesn't end a behavior. We all know this to be true. But for things that are really, really deeply morally wrong, we see use of the state force and the state banning it. We see that as justifiable. And so for pro-life people like myself, the idea that somehow libertarianism permits abortion at all kinds of different stages, wherever you want to draw that line, I'm not comfortable ever running that risk that we could possibly be permitting a woman to kill a developing human life. And I think it's really annoying. We use all kinds of terrible rhetoric when we talk about this. We call it a potential life. I mean, there's nothing potential. Like the metaphysical reality of like the 34-week-old fetus inside of me right now in this room with us is such that like he exists. He feels pain. He moves around. He has a brain that's somewhat developed. It's a hard sell to me to try to convince me that this is worthless or that it would in some way be consistent with the non-aggression principle for me to go to a hospital on the Upper East Side and have them cut him out of me and suction him out. I don't understand how libertarians can act as if the pro-life side, many of us aren't happy about the idea of state force and increased state surveillance and all of the second order impacts that would arise from this. But I think many of us see it as, well, look, we're participating in a moral travesty when every day that we allow abortion to be permitted in this country. And it's a really inconvenient view. I would love nothing more than to have pro-choice beliefs, but there's ultimately nothing that I can do to really rationalize and justify that. And I think
so
the more you learn—
So how far back do you take it, though? Because you were talking about a kind of development of the fetus as meaningful.
Yeah.
Is it from the moment of conception? Is it from implantation? Because I think you're making a great case. And Matt, the thing that got me about this letter isn't the issue or the fact that libertarians disagree, because I think libertarians actually disagree on a wide range of issues. And you have people like Randy Barnett, who, you know, is like a libertarian anarchist, you know, legal eagle, who is okay with lots of forms of gun control, you know, and like, is he not a libertarian? I won't speak for other libertarians. When I talk about about the abortion issue, I don't write people out of the movement because they disagree with me on it. And so the whole frame of the question is wrong as far as I'm concerned. It's just empirically wrong, at least as it relates to me. But then we get into some of the other policy things. And it's like, is it from the moment of conception? Because from however defined, from a libertarian perspective especially, that immediately raises a lot of issues about state surveillance in the name of protecting the rights of the fetus. I am comfortable, and I wrote about this when the Dobbs decision came down, the idea that, you know, it's up through the middle of the 19th century, there was a folk wisdom. And of course, you know, you can immediately say folk wisdom is bullshit, or that's what we've been escaping for the past 1,000 years of human development. And there's some truth to that, right? But in the United States, and this is where Samuel Alito, Damon Root wrote about this at Reason and other people have elsewhere, was fundamentally wrong when he was like, oh, you know what, there were no, you know, abortion was just banned. It was illegal. It was recognized as illegal when the 14th Amendment was passed. In fact, like most states did not criminalize abortion before quickening. The Catholic Church only, you know, it's a modern doctrine of the Catholic Church that life begins at the moment of conception. It comes out of the Vatican Council I and like the kind of rejection of modernity. There is a wide range of ways of talking about personhood, because I think the Libertarian Party in its first platform talked about there are two sets of rights, and they actually were okay with Roe, which is not a blank check for abortion. It's saying that up through the first trimester, the state does not have an interest. And then as the fetus develops, the state actually has more of an interest. And I think that reflected the way that Americans think about abortion. And I think it's an actually good solution. And it's not the one that we have now.
Peter, to get you in on this politically, and to kind of move the discussion to where news is developing on this. Last week in New York, there was a special congressional election in New York 19, which is a pretty divided red-blue Hudson Valley, upstate New York situation. And Mark Molinaro, who's a well-known Republican, who's doing well in all the polls leading up to it, lost to Pat Ryan, a Democrat who focused really heavily on abortion all the time. And I think Molinaro was basically trying not to talk about it. And now we're starting to see people like Blake Masters in Arizona, whose candidacy is really struggling.
Scrubbing his life begins at the moment of conception, sanctity of support for a sanctity of life amendment.
As Nick was saying, there's been a bit of a rebound of Biden and the Democrats in their long kind of expected, predicted up to the midterm slide that we've seen now. There's starting to be numerical evidence. Do you think that we're in a case of, like, politically wise, Republicans or pro-life Republicans were the dog that caught the car? Like, they weren't ready to deal with the political ramifications of what happens when they finally get what they've been fighting for 50 years.
Shockingly, Republicans were not exactly on the ball when it comes to coming up with actual policies to back up their stated political beliefs. And now it looks like they may be paying for that somewhat at the polls. I do think it's somewhat difficult to predict these things, you know, weeks or months out from any election. At the same time, I think that it is distinctly possible that Democrats will somewhat overperform the fundamentals in terms of Biden's approval rating and the economy in 2022, in the midterm here in November. And they will say, well, it's because of the Inflation Reduction Act and it's because of, you know, student loan forgiveness, but it will actually be because of Dobbs and because Republicans don't really know how to talk about abortion in a post-Dobbs era. I do actually just want to respond directly to the question, though, since I would take issue with the idea that everyone on the roundtable is pro-choice. I don't identify that way. And in fact, I introduced the the discussion that we had. I believe it was the week that that Dobbs came down. Maybe it was the week right before, earlier this summer, by explicitly noting that not every libertarian is pro-choice, despite what we may regularly hear on the roundtable. And it's just, you know, I would not say that that I have a sort of super strong view one way or the other here. I'm sort of philosophically somewhat pro-life and legally and practically somewhat pro-choice, but those aren't strongly held views either way. I do think that, you know, libertarians believe that the state can intervene to protect people, to protect innocence from acts of violence, and that's not inherently libertarian. And so it's just not at all obvious to me that libertarians should be strongly pro-choice. At the same time, I'm mostly just glad to work someplace where we where both views are represented and where, you know, we have colleagues who can in good faith engage in debate with each other and respect each other's views. And so I just disagree with the premise that everybody here, you know, on the roundtable is just staunchly and glibly pro-choice. And I also, I don't think that represents the roundtable, and I don't think it represents reason.
There's also just, I mean, pro-choicers so frequently hide from the reality of the procedure and the stages of fetal development. They don't focus on that at all. I think because it doesn't work rhetorically, it's not convincing to people to you know, join their side. And pro-lifers very much hide from the reality of the consequences of their policy, which is that some number of poor families' plights will be made much worse because they will have more children than they want to have, sometimes children that they cannot care for well, sometimes children that they cannot afford. And this is what, a post-Roe America looks like. And we need to be comfortable with some amount of that. Even looking at the demographics of what type of woman typically seeks abortions, a lot of the times they're women who are my age, between the ages of like 25 and 30 or 35. You know, 25% of them are upper middle class, 25% of them are pretty thoroughly middle class, and about 50% are legitimately poor. You know, lots of different women seek abortions. Many of them already have a child at home. But I think pro-lifers do need to own the fact that this will make some number of people's lives worse and some number of families, It'll force them into more desperate situations than they would have been otherwise. And
including
I think there's
being exposed to the criminal justice system.
Yeah,
which
there's
is
a ton of.
Serious.
I mean, I think about this because I'm 34 weeks pregnant and I've been drinking throughout this entire pregnancy. Okay, well,
I didn't want to say anything, but she's been drinking throughout this entire pod.
Non-alcoholic beer, folks. It's great.
No, it's
but
extra.
To what degree,
it was a heavy IPA. Mostly.
But to what degree could this invite, you know, the state into my decisions and attempt to suss out the degree to which I'm chemically endangering or neglecting my child when, in fact, I am making a decision that is informed by neurotically reading a bunch of Emily Oster research and thinking that ACOG recommendations are far too strict and don't actually take pregnant women's preferences and lifestyles into account. To some degree, I am the person who stands to bear a lot of the brunt of this, perhaps, you know, less so than a poor woman would, but I'm not happy about a lot of those possible implications of this. I think one of the best things that libertarians are well suited to do is not just consider all of the different ways public policy could go about handling this, but to consider all the ways we could tinker at the margins to improve this situation. Fundamentally, the stakes got higher for sexually active people, and people might be more incentivized to be really careful about what types
this?
Of birth control they
$10,000 every time you have sex.
No, but I do think we could make.
But sorry, Matt, only if you have a college degree, because that means you're in debt.
I think that's the Viktor Orban's policy in Hungary.
Yeah.
I do think, though, you could make it so that healthcare and employment are no longer tied together. Right. You could make it so that there are better women's shelters available. You could allow people to choose more healthcare options from a marketplace of a whole bunch of competitive packages. You could have a whole bunch of tech innovation around male birth control to make it so that this burden is shouldered by both partners. You could have Plan B in every bodega and in every fucking airport, right? Like, there are lots and lots
and
of different ways.
And not behind the counter or anything.
Yeah. Or you could make it so that more IUDs flood the marketplace the way that they do in a lot of European countries and in Canada. But for some reason, the U.S., doesn't
not
really
for some
allow
reason,
that.
Because for the FDA.
Shield, yeah.
And the way the FDA actually regulates medical devices, particularly IUDs, because of a big scandal in the 70s.
Dalcon Shield, yeah, exactly. I mean, there are so many ways we could go about not, we could choose not to squabble about this, and we could instead actually attempt to reduce all of the red tape and all of the hurdles that make people's lives actively worse.
Having
because
said
people
that,
have sex.
I mean,
we
this,
have to accept
it
that.
Is. You know, two things in this conversation, and Liz, I really appreciate you, you know, having this conversation the way that you're having it, because it's you're very pregnant, and it's great. No, and like to talk
you
openly.
Just call me fat. You can just say.
I didn't realize you were pregnant until like 10 minutes ago, so I didn't want to say anything. No, but you know, to also talk about your lifestyle choices during pregnancy, because you know, pregnancy is a battlefield. It's one of the last unacknowledged attempts to control the female body. In modern society.
100% true.
And it's disturbing as hell. But there, you know, one thing that comes up is the technology. I mean, you know, the abortion rate has been going down for decades, and the incidence is lower than it was, even with many more people in the country than it was when Roe started. And that's kind of great because it means people are having fewer unwanted pregnancies or unplanned pregnancies and things like that, you know, which is good. There's more control there. Generationally, it's also fascinating to think about, you know, and a lot of people say that the improvement in kind of ultrasounds and whatnot has fundamentally changed the relationship that people have to fetuses. And I know even between my first son, who is 28, and my younger son, who's 21, in like a 7.5-year period between them, the technology got so much better. That was once kind of like a blurry Rorschach test, which, you know, realistically could have been anything the doctor was pointing to when they were saying like, oh, and this is going on. And
now it's like classic Disney animation.
Yeah, but it's interesting to think about how, you know, these things, we want to be moral absolutes. This is a right, and it extends in all circumstances under, you know, for all reasons. You know, something like abortion, and to be honest, like all of our rights, including the right to speech and, you know, the right to travel and gun rights and everything are so embedded in a social context, the more conversation we have about them, probably the less sure we're going to be about any one position, but the better I would think we would be as a society.
Let's dictatorially cut short this conversation so that Liz doesn't give birth in this hot studio. Well,
that would be the biggest episode, at least of the month,
since
the year.
Who would I choose to deliver the baby out of the two of you? I don't know who's more competent.
Well, I am a Boy Scout and a former lifeguard, an Eagle Scout.
Are you volunteering?
I'm just saying
I've got great.
Could you guys just do me a favor? And if that happens,
Matt did play third base
on your Skype feed first.
No. Yeah. Because Peter, there's no like, you know, in Red Death Redemption 2, there isn't a scene in a wagon train where
I have to say though,
the old coot, the chuck wagon master has to deliver a baby.
I have been thinking about this a lot though, because my husband, who's been mostly pretty supportive throughout this pregnancy, last night put on Kill Bill while we were falling asleep. And I was just like, really? We're going to watch the pregnant woman bloodied up? Like,
not supportive. All right. Just saying, there's all the alcohol you need right behind us from Fifth Column listeners here. So we can desensitize anything that needs to happen. All right. Let's get to our, speaking of Kill Bill, our end of a podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. I will not pick on Nick first since he's cramming for the homework. Suderman, why don't you start us off?
I watched the movie Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. It is a teen black comic horror flick. Not quite teenagers. I guess they're all like young adults with the exception of one of the characters. It's a sort of a satire of kind of teenage internet, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter culture, and also a little bit of a satire of like the teen slasher genre. And it's great. It's funny as hell. It's super dark, super, super mean. I mean, just like the point of the movie is that every single character is awful. Like, it just, it breaks every rule of screenwriting. And they're like, you know, you want to sell a screenplay in Hollywood, they're always looking for, they have terms like rootability, right? It's not just that you want to relate to them. You want to root for these people. You want to, they need to be here. No, there's no heroes here. Every single person is just an absolutely awful piece of shit to each other. They pretend to be friends and they're terrible and they're rich and they're so smug and they speak in like terrible, useless, meaningless internet lingo the whole time. It's a lot like this podcast, except they actually kill each other rather than just think about it. And so, you know, people die off in this mansion during a hurricane party, and you don't know, you know, who's killing them and why and what sort of how this is all going on. There's a great twist at the end of it. But I just want to say that I recommend this movie as an example of really great reactionary filmmaking. This is not like a small C conservative movie in, you know, the William F. Buckley sense. And it's not like a libertarian movie, you know, philosophically ideological, nothing like that. But what it is, this is a young person's movie that is made in reaction to like to the awfulness of left-leaning sort of woke contemporary PC culture. And it just takes it as a given that all of that stuff is stupid and awful, and all of the people who engage in it are stupid and awful. And the twist in the movie, which I will not reveal because it is so good.
Come on. Come on, we're not going to watch it.
Just like puts such a great bow on the whole thing. And I suspect that this is like the first of a coming wave of movies and pop culture that are aimed at, you know, it's younger folks, at people under 30 and really under 25, who have grown up in a sort of stifling and conformist speech environment where everybody is sort of like, you can't make fun of anything. You can't like have, you can't just, see, there's a lot of words you can't say. And where there's all of these sort of like verbal tics, you know, words like toxic and stuff, which I think is the subject of Pete Davidson's great like little mini monologue at the beginning of the movie about how like, this is just a word that people use on Twitter that people have used so much that it now doesn't mean anything. You just deploy it because you don't have any other way to talk about the world. And that's what this movie is about how there are all these words out there that now like people use and they don't, because they don't have any other way to talk about the world, and because they're actually kind of vapid and terrible. And it's a great piece of reactionary art. It's funny, it's short, it's to the point. And strongly recommend it. I think it is going to it is going to herald like a new wave of sort of anti PC, anti left, anti woke art that is, again, not designed to like, oh, you know, it's not about like how we should vote for Ted Cruz. It's just about how
remember that picture of Ted Cruz,
you know, sort of speech orthodoxy that has come out of like the left and academia and sort of young
so
person's
is it
culture
this
is
generation's
terrible.
Animal House, Peter? Is it this generation's Animal House?
It's not as zany as that, and it's meaner.
Hmm. I blame Animal House for the rise in college.
A lot of bad
costs.
Stuff. Yeah, yeah. Actually, it did. It helped. It helped people want to go to college. I, Peter, you had me until Pete Davidson.
Yeah.
And if we could alter, and I wish there was a like a program where you could just put Christopher Plummer in for any actor that you dislike. Remember when that was Christopher Plummer
That's
was
right.
sutured in for Kevin Spacey and everybody.
Nick, what did you consume?
I am reading. I'm almost done. And this is the type of book which I think is called ludic reading. As soon as I started, I fell into a trance in this, and I love this world. It's a memoir by Stephen Heller. And I'll explain who he is in a second. It's Growing Up Underground, a memoir of counterculture New York. And Steve Heller is widely quoted in Brian Doherty's recent book about underground comics. Steve Heller worked at Screw Magazine and a bunch of the New York Free Press. He ended up being a New York Times art director for decades of both the op-ed page as well as the book review section and whatnot. He is this incredible figure who was a teenager in the late 60s and ended up rolling into this incredible decade of just the efflorescence of underground culture everywhere, you know, which much of it emanated from New York. He was a dirty, filthy hippie who wandered around Greenwich Village, was not a big drug taker, not lucky with the ladies or anything. So he's an odd duck to be kind of chronicling this. But it's a fascinating world that explains a lot of where we are and all of Peter was talking about a reaction to the last, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 years. A lot of that is a reaction to an earlier iteration, which was blowing apart kind of mainstream culture where you couldn't say a lot of things and you couldn't do a lot of things. And that itself became vapid and uninteresting. You know, I cannot highly recommend Growing Up Underground by Stephen Heller, a memoir of counterculture in New York enough. It's a phenomenal, you know, kind of book about the root of where a lot of what we're talking about comes from.
All right, Liz Wolf, besides Kill Bill Volume 7, what pregnancy slasher fiction did you consume?
I have been watching the FX Hulu show The Bear, which follows a fine dining chef who I believe logged some time at places like Noma, like some of the most reputable restaurants in the world, and returns to Chicago, to the original Beef of Chicagoland, his sort of family-owned restaurant after the suicide of his older brother, who'd been running it for a long time. Chaos ensues.
Hilarity?
Some amount of hilarity. I do think it's a really interesting, very chef and kitchen-focused show. And in some ways, it falls into some of the obnoxious, like, millennial Bon Appetit reader trappings of name-checking places like Alinea and Noma and the French Laundry. And there's sort of it's almost like there's a bingo card of things that people who like food give a shit about, and they just sort of went through and checked all of them off.
Are there a lot of scenes of, like, you know, knife work, exquisite knife work?
Well, yeah. I think it's better than that, though, because it does show a little bit of this clash between fine dining world and what it actually takes to run a shitty sandwich shop in Chicago. It's also it feels like a little bit like a love letter to Chicago in a way that I appreciate. We so often see tons and tons of New York-focused media, and I, as a native Texan,
that you're not going to read Stephen Heller's great Growing Up Underground, a memoir of counterculture in New York.
No, but I think, you know, as a Texan, I enjoy a lot of the Linklater stuff. I enjoyed Boyhood a lot, and I really appreciate places that works of art that take you to a place and really use the place as a character in their portrayal, and I think this does this very beautifully with Chicago. There's honestly a lot of like portrayal of addiction in this, and I really do appreciate the way that they show this like worlds colliding type situation, and they do a really good job with the pacing, where it's fast paced because it's in a kitchen, but the actual plot revelations are very, very slow paced, sort of doled out, really making you work for it. But the thing that I think is really interesting about this, and I think about this with kitchen culture and with tattoo culture, these are both industries that have historically had strong traditions of hazing and dues paying. And I think especially in recent years with all the Me Too movement type stuff, there's been a lot of people who've been calling attention to the degree to which there are all these abusive bosses and all of these really awful people with terrible reputations, and this weeding out, this rooting out of people like that. And I'm always very torn as to whether or not the idea of people asking for better treatment is a good thing versus the degree to which these industries are absolutely sculpted and molded by this culture of hazing and this culture of, like, I don't know if I can say the word pussy on this, but, like, you can't be a pussy in order
to...
You
have to give Matt a warning so he can go out in the hallway. It's okay, Matt. Come back here.
But no, I mean, you can't be a pussy if you want to get ahead in these really intense environments. And I think to some degree... Obviously I'm the youngest millennial, youngest little segment of the millennial generation. And I think millennials are especially sensitive to this idea of like, oh, well, you shouldn't have to deal with all kinds of exploitation and abuse in order to rise in the ranks in tattooing or to rise in the ranks in a kitchen. But I think I wonder, is something lost when we beg for this ultra sensitive treatment? At the same time, I have also been relatively insulated from terrible, terrible treatment at the hands of employers. I have to say that because I'm filling in for Catherine. So,
right.
You know, we all have to be on our best behavior. But I'm
and
very...
Matt has control of the microphone.
Hey, Liz.
I'm torn on these fundamental questions.
Did you see Pig with Nicolas Cage, the movie that came out last
year? No, I haven't seen it yet.
First of all, it's wonderful. It was my favorite movie of last year. But I'm just interested. I would be curious to hear you sort of... talk about the differences between The Bear, which I haven't seen, and Pig, because Pig was about deconstructing the pretensions of elite dining culture in Portland, while also kind of representing the real beauty and pleasure and human connection of great cooking and food, right? Rather than just sort of showing off that you paid $300 for dinner and like it looks weird and it's got ingredients you've never heard of. And I'm just sort of curious, like I would be curious to someone who I know
you
are like a foodie.
Throw in Chef by John Favreau, which I think is just a big way of him hiding his obesity.
I just that's like how
he has a really hot wife in that, right?
He writes
like
himself
an
a hot wife.
Probably hot wife when he's like 600 pounds. He's like, you know, Orson Welles was his stunt double or something. Look,
if you're that rich.
And that like the searing of the Cuban sandwich.
I don't like the excessive fixation on food porn. And to the Bear's credit, there are some sort of name-checky references that I find really grating, but there's not too much food porn emphasis. And I think that makes it better.
The kind of situation that you're describing at the heart of, you know, a lot of the tension for you, though, is can we say it's not like, okay, you either have to put up with Mario Batali, a Rutgers grad, by the way, who got his first job at a place called Stuff Your Face on Easton Avenue that makes strombolis that had become a shrine to him. And now they have like, you could still see the places on the wall where they pulled everything down because Mario Batali was a serial harasser who was like grabbing people's tits.
But not like a rapist, that, right? Like...
I don't, but not a rapist. I don't, you know, yeah, I guess not.
Not a Nazi either. I'm like a Louis C.K. truther where I'm like, Louis C.K. did nothing wrong.
But right? I'm just saying, like, it doesn't have to be one or the other. And you can have like a hazing or an apprenticeship that is demanding and, you know, rises to high levels of, you know, standards and things like that without it becoming, you know, like truly abusive on some level.
Acknowledge that these heat lamps here, which should have been turned down,
it's wonderful.
Are truly abusive. And so I would like to not extend the conversation to.
But it's a good question, isn't it?
It's an excellent question. Yeah. It's a fodder for future debate.
I feel like we're like Ken, what's his name? Ken Wall and Paul Newman in Fort Apache, the Bronx.
Who's Paul Newman?
Yeah.
Which one of
them? I don't know.
Exactly.
He's a salad dressing magnate who made
films
on the side.
Which one of us is Paul Newman?
Oh, I am. Because he's the old guy in a bad neighborhood who is, he's old and about to retire, but an idealist.
But I have
and then the younger
literally
person,
just said,
and
let's
this is
stop
Ken Wall
going down rabbit holes.
Motorcycle accidents.
We're on Ken Wall motorcycle accidents. Shut up.
I just, I think this is the time for the producer.
I thought you were in favor of free
Nelly's,
speech, Matt.
I'm against it. I'm hazing. Everyone,
I've had to stop riding motorcycles and mopeds due to the baby. It's really horrible.
I read a book with a title that only should be read as follows: "Broken News: Why the Media Rage Machine Divides America and How to Fight Back." by Chris Steigerwald. And it's sad that that's the title of it, because that sounds like one of those books that, you know, Laura Ingraham could sell or something like that. And it's really, that's not the book at all. Chris Steigerwald was a political news director at Fox News for a long time, famously got bounced out of there because Fox News's decision desk called Arizona for Joe Biden in the 2020 elections before anybody else did. And there was a lot of pushback. The Trump family was really mad. A lot of people were mad. And eventually Fox got mad at him for being the guy who did it.
Although he was right.
He was absolutely right. Yeah.
Like, so it's not like he was going out on a limb or he's a secret anti-Trumper or something.
The book is not about that, but he does acknowledge at the top that he's was part of his motivation for doing it. So he's writing about the media scene as it happens right now. What's good about it in particular is that he focuses a lot on the problem of consumption. He's basically saying that our tribalism is making journalism bad and journalistic tribalism is making it worse. And then there are a bunch of other factors that we've talked about a lot on the podcast.
Can we talk about them now?
That the legislative branch abdicating its responsibility, that all these sort of clownish people on the left like AOC, on the right like Matt Gaetz, are just trying to suck up oxygen and getting C-SPAN attention, and they're not actually doing anything about legislation. So it's sort of creating this kind of thing. Our nationalization of attention in politics means that people are looking for meaning in really stupid kind of organization of hatreds types of ways. It's a very interesting book on that if you're interested in it. Chris Steigerwald, he now works at the Dispatch, I believe. And I interviewed him for this book for C-SPAN Books. It'll be coming on sometime soon. I don't know exactly when. So check that
out. How will we know when you do? I want to see that. When I heard when you were doing it, like for book notes or something.
Yeah,
like an hour-long program where you.
I will tweet it out. So follow Matt Welch on Twitter. There you go. Plug for Matt Welch. It's about time.
It's so much better than the M. Lee Welch that you started with, right?
Yeah. It took a long while.
You were named after Lee Harvey Oswald. That's what your father told me. I don't know if he ever told you that.
He left that out. We're done. Thank you for listening. Go to all our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. You know which ones I'm talking about. I'm not going to name them. I'm not going to waste time by naming each of the individual podcasts.
Can we title this Safe? Safe or whatever,
legal
safe at medium rare.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean it
goes without saying
it titled itself. And if you like what we do as a organization or an organization even, go to reason.com/
new organization
and give us the bitcoins. Okay, thanks, goodbye.